discount code FRUITS.
Valley Talk on News Talk 1580 KGAL.
Welcome to KGAL's Valley Talk. Jeff McMahon, your host, sponsored today by J&J Electric in Albany. They've got a big, beautiful showroom there dedicated to everything decorative and electrical. And a knowledgeable staff ready to help you with your project. 50 years of knowledge, as a matter of fact. It's been more than 50 years. They've been right there serving the Mid-Willamette Valley, 22nd and South Pacific in Albany, J&J Electric. Their website, j-jelectric.com. We thank them for sponsoring Valley Talk today. Our guest in this portion of the program, Ingrid Newkirk. Ingrid, the founder and president of PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and the author of a new book along with co-author Gene Stone. It's called Animal Kind, Remarkable Discoveries About Animals and Revolutionary New Ways to Show Them Compassion. Good morning, Ingrid. Thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Jeff. Thanks very much for doing this.
Tell us a bit about yourself and how you fell in love with animals. And then as you tell your story, would you just kind of branch into how PETA got started?
Well, I grew up, like many people, thinking that I loved animals. I did. But also not realizing that I hadn't connected the dots. I'm 70 now. So when I was growing up, my father and I basically ate our way through the animal kingdom.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had my first fur coat when I was 19, and I thought I looked just wonderful in it. There were no animal rights activists then to say, excuse me, do you know that coyotes are caught in steel traps or foxes are farmed? You know, they go mad on the fur farms. There was no one really to talk to us about that. There weren't vegan options. I mean, nobody knew. If you'd said the word vegan, they would have thought you meant that you came from Las Vegas or something.
Sure.
And the animals were used in experiments just willy-nilly. We hadn't had the technological breakthroughs that we've had today. And so people just captured them in the wild for zoos, for circuses, for experiments. It makes me think back to this, actually, when I hear stories about us going out into space looking for intelligent life. I always think, well, gosh, you know, we've got intelligent life all around us here on Earth, and what do we do to it? So let's hope that if we find intelligent life out in space, it's more compassionate than we are. But over a series of experiences, I really was a slow learner. I figured out that animals are probably not here for us to use, that they're full of joy and life, and they value freedom, and they want to have fun. They don't want to be hurt. And I came to think of them the way that I had felt about my dog when I was growing up, that he was just another person in the house, and that we played together, slept in, you know, his bed or my bed, went out and both got car sick at the same time. So I suddenly realized it's not just dogs, it's not just cats, and even them we give short shrift to. But look how they're being used in places that most people never go to. I mean, how many people do you know who've been to a slaughterhouse or a factory farm or into a laboratory or any of those places? And so because I saw those things as an inspector for a government agency in Maryland and then in the District of Columbia, my eyes were opened and I was horrified at what I was supporting with my consumer dollars. Just buying things was hurting animals. That's the last thing I wanted. So I started People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals to do two things. And one is to show people like me what is going on that people who sell animal bits and pieces don't tell you. And the second is to do the homework for everybody and say, here are alternatives you'll like, so you can make a kind choice instead of a cruel one, even if you're at the moment doing that, making that bad choice unwittingly. So that's how PETA was formed.
Ingrid, I find it both refreshing and very intriguing that you include yourself in the examples of people who maybe were a part of the mistreatment of animals prior to your founding PETA. I think that's very interesting.
Well, I used to go fishing when I first moved to the U.S. I didn't think twice about fish, really, except I always knew you should, I always believed you should kill them quickly. You shouldn't let them dangle around in pain. But I didn't know how sensitive their mouths are, for example, and I dismissed them the way we do, thinking, oh, they're just these weird-looking, thin, small beings. You know, they're not as attractive as whales or dolphins. They're just those things. And so I had a lot of waking up to do, and the more research I did and the more I thought about it, I thought, well, actually, just because they don't look like me, just because they may have a language I don't understand, and they do, all these animals communicate with each other, just that we don't understand it, they have amazing abilities I didn't even know about. They have, even little fish have long memories. If you trap one in a net and they get away, 7 years later, that's all we know, but up to 7 years later, they know how to not do that again. So I thought, well, I need to change what I'm doing because I don't like cruelty to animals, and maybe it's a bigger area of interest than I ever thought it was.
You're listening to Ingrid Newkirk, who was the founder and president of PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and she's written a book along with co-author Gene Stone called Animal Kind, Remarkable Discoveries About Animals and Revolutionary New Ways to Show Them Compassion. This is a brand new book. It's out in your bookstore right now. And if you're unable to get into your bookstore because of the coronavirus situation that we're facing now, or for whatever reason, you certainly can order it via Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And that's called Animal Kind, Remarkable Discoveries About Animals and Revolutionary New Ways to Show Them Compassion. So what was it that led to the writing of this book, Ingrid?
Well, it's PETA's 40th anniversary this year, and I wanted to have a book that really told people who animals are, not what, you know, they're not tables and chairs, but who, their personalities, their individuals, and they're important. And so I already had a huge collection of information about animals, but I started to explore other things too. And I learned so much because animals have a whole world of sensations that are completely unknown to us. For example, we can't see ultraviolet light, but bees and butterflies can. And we just see these few shades of color, and we're content with that throughout our lives. But so many animals, including birds, pigeons, ducks, can see a whole range of colors we can't see. There's a beautiful little video on the internet of a group of ducks. They're at a stop sign at a traffic light in, I think it's Austria, and they're looking at the red light, and they're not crossing the road because they have observed that that's a dangerous time, and they're watching that red light. It changes to green, and they all go across the road.
How about
Someone
that?
Said to me, oh, but I'm not sure ducks can see red and green. Yes, they can. They have an extra cone in their eye that actually makes those colors more vibrant. But to me, the most interesting thing is that animals observe us because we control the world. I mean, dogs are dependent on us even to relieve themselves or to go for a walk, to have a drink of water. And so they watch us intently, and they figure things out. And I think most human children could not do the things that most animals can do when they're just 1 year or 2 years old. Like a cow can figure out how to operate a water pump with her horns.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And horses in Finland have figured out, they've been taught that if you're cold, which I imagine you would be in Finland, you can press this symbol with your nose, and that means we'll come out and put a blanket on you, and you press the other symbol, and we'll take it off. So everywhere you look, animals are able to read the stars. The squirrels bury their nuts by the position of the sun, of the stars. Pigeons, who are fabulous parents, will fly using navigating by low-frequency radio waves when we didn't even know there were radio waves when I was just a few years before I was born. So it's all fascinating. And once I think people realize that they are just like us, they experience joy and love and grief and all the rest of it. Then the second part of the book is, what are the ways that we can change our habits so we're not inadvertently hurting them? And how can we respect them more and not really be what we call human supremacists?
That's Ingrid Newkirk, the author of the new book, Animal Kind, Remarkable Discoveries About Animals and Revolutionary New Ways to Show Them Compassion. Now, Ingrid did mention prior to our going on air that she had noticed that there was another book that has just come out recently also that has the same title, which is a very unfortunate thing. I think you'd agree with that, Ingrid.
Yes.
But so you want to look for that subtitle. It's Remarkable Discoveries About Animals and Revolutionary New Ways to Show Them Compassion. And look for Ingrid's name, Ingrid Newkirk, and her co-author, Jean Stone. This book has a beautiful picture of a parrot up by the title of the book, and then pretty much every other species of animal you could think of that would have been on Noah's Ark there, pictured just below. So you'll be able to see it. It's a white cover with a black print and the beautiful full-color photos of the animals there on the cover. Animal Kind, Remarkable Discoveries About Animals and Revolutionary New Ways to Show Them Compassion. Available in your bookstore and online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the typical outlets where you could buy new books. So tell us a little bit about why you divided this up into two sections, because it seems as if you could possibly have just sort of mixed and matched and followed more of a conversational approach, but you decided to break it down into two different sections.
I did, because when I was writing the book, I found that people who I was showing bits of it to kept saying, oh, I want to know more about that. I want to know more about that. And I didn't want to suddenly switch them over. Of course, anyone can go to the second part of the book and immediately see what you can do about something that you're reading. But there are things in there, too, that are just fascinating about animals that we don't necessarily interfere with. And by that, I mean, for example, gorillas play tag. They'll just do, you know, got it, you're it, and they'll swap roles. And so you see all these things of animals going out of their way because they can't go to the store, they can't order on Amazon, going out of their way to what we would call steal food, but it's just because they can't get it themselves and we've got it all for ourselves in really incredible ways. Like dogs will push a chair up against the kitchen counter and then jump on it, get on the kitchen counter, open the cupboard door, take out what they want, and in some cases put the chair back afterwards so that you will think, where did that go? Or you might not notice it. So some of these things are just amusing, but they do open our eyes to how clever animals are. And I do think sometimes when people, you see them walking their dogs. At the moment, dogs are getting longer walks, but usually people are so taken up with their own lives that they're hurrying that dog along as if the only reason the dog is outside is to do their business and get back inside. That's an excursion for that dog. It's an important, wonderful time when we need to get over ourselves and allow them to smell the bushes. It's their internet. They're reading the news on those bushes, and we should let them bark sometimes, not to disturb people. But we bark all day long, and we listen to other people barking on the news, on the television, the radio, and so on. So dogs need to be dogs. Even that, I think, comes across without having to say to people, and this is what you have to do, because it's obvious that we are not paying as much attention as we should. But even elephants, I mean, we're not going to see an elephant on the street this morning, presumably. But people go on holiday, they go on vacation. And they might be, if you will, suckered into going to one of these fake elephant orphanages and riding an elephant and not realize, as I've pointed out in the book, there are no real elephant orphanages in places like Thailand. It's the babies taken away from their mothers. And if you look behind the scenes, you'll see them all in chains going absolutely stir crazy. So you learn a lot.
So we'll be learning about these things in this book. But yet, as I read through the book, I didn't feel like I was being spanked on the hand all the time. You know, there are folks who would be listening who would think PETA, people for ethical treatment of animals. I remember them. They're just going to preach at me about how I'm doing all these things wrong, and that really this book doesn't have that kind of spirit to it at all.
No, I mean, sometimes at PETA, we really do have to say, hey, look at this. You're not going to find a retailer showing you what the animals go through to make this product or to get this on the marketplace. So, hey, look at this. These are the uncomfortable facts. But the book is what we do mostly, and that is ask people to open their minds, open their hearts, you know, to think about who animals are, and then make their own decisions. And I do believe, and experience shows me, I mean, I was one of the people who had to make a lot of changes as I learned things. I do believe most people, everyone who is kind, will think, aha, I didn't know that. And then they might reflect and do something differently. And we are here always as a resource. Now, we don't want people to be sad or angry. We want people to know there are compassionate choices and that they're easy to make. And so we have lists of cruelty-free cosmetics and household cleaning products, lists of alternatives to dissection, for example, like the fabulous synthetic frog, which has a membrane just like a regular frog, but your child can cut that frog up and not hurt real ones. We have all sorts of resources available, and we're always happy to help if anybody wants to explore them.
And that is much of what the second part of the book is about. It's a book that's titled Animal Kind, Remarkable Discoveries About Animals and Revolutionary New Ways to Show Them Compassion, written by Ingrid Newkirk, our guest, and co-author Jean Stone. Who is Jean, and how did you two get together on this project?
Jean is a lovely man. He actually wrote the book Forks Over Knives, which people may have heard of. There's a film of the same name. It is quite compelling and makes the case that factory farming and slaughterhouses and so on are places you just don't want to support. And it talks about human health a lot. It's a lot about heart disease and diabetes and the problems that plague people and kill 3 out of 4 Americans every year, and the rest of the world too. And so I found him through that book, and I know he's a kind man. He fosters cats for a humane society when he's able to. And I spoke to him. He has ghostwritten a lot of books, too, and we decided to split it up and write half each and collaborate on it.
Wonderful. Well, you did a wonderful job.
Oh, thanks very much. I was really looking forward to this book because I have files and files of facts about animals, and I definitely want to share them with people who care about animals, too. And then in the course of the research, I learned so much more. I mean, I really didn't know so many things that are in the book. And I think that just as they interested me, they will interest anybody who cares about any animals. And it's from the tiniest animal, little snails, who, if you take them away from their home, and I'm not recommending anybody do, but people do because they're eating their garden plants, and they know that's their home. And they will spend a year, if they have to, trying to get back to it at a speed of 0.029 miles an hour.
Oh, my.
I mean, there are things about snails, things about elephants who swim because they just adore it if they're allowed to in places like Sri Lanka where they're not chained up all the time, lumber elephants, wood-cutting elephants. They will jump into the sea and they will swim up to 30 miles just for the sheer delight. And they use their trunks as snorkels above the water with their heads underneath it.
How about that? Mm. I did not know that about that. Here's something that I found interesting about your book was the compassion and emotion that it has been discovered that animals feel. Now, we have long known that our dogs, for example, definitely feel emotions and have human-like qualities in that regard. But there are a lot of other animals that it's been discovered actually feel feelings and not just think thoughts.
Oh, they all do. I'm firmly convinced now they all do. You're right. We tend to say they're human emotions, and of course they're not. They're shared emotions. And we see that the more we look at animals. Everybody, I think, knows that elephants cradle the bones of departed elephants and grieve. Cows do the same thing. They will stand over another cow who has died, who they know. And cows actually shed tears. Elephants and cows are basically in the same family when it comes to this. They shed actual tears. You can see cows on a cattle truck, and they, it's, you know, something is coming out of their eyes, and it's water. But we do know that, for example, pigeons, and so many people just dismiss pigeons. Oh, they're dirty. They're not. Pigeons are fabulous mothers and fathers, and they each, the male and the female, make milk in their crop to feed their baby. And if you see, they take turns looking after the baby. If you see a pigeon with their beak down another pigeon's beak, two things. It may be they're kissing, because they actually do that. They're quite sensuous, and their lovemaking is extraordinarily sensitive. Or they may just be feeding their child, and it could be the male or it could be the female. They are so loyal. Like most birds, swans, geese, pigeons, they mate for life. They find their high school sweetheart, and they stick with them until their dying day, unless something happens.
Wow, a lot of interesting, and there's so much more you'll learn in this wonderful new book. We've been speaking with the author, Ingrid Newkirk. She is the founder of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and is also a terrific author, and has written a book with Jean Stone called Animal Kind, Remarkable Discoveries About Animals and Revolutionary New Ways to Show Them Compassion. Ingrid, it's been a pleasure to chat with you, and I hope everybody gets your book, and I hope that you have a wonderful rest of your day. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jeff, very much.
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Marcus Wheaton with the Pittsburgh Steelers. Whether I'm in town for bye week or for the offseason, I get regular chiropractic adjustments and massage therapy from the doctors and therapists at Christ Chiropractic Clinic. Whether from playing in Pittsburgh with the Steelers or back when I played with the Beavers, I found that along with exercise and conditioning, getting regular chiropractic adjustments helps me play and feel better. I look forward to playing many more years in the NFL and will continue to rely on doctors and therapists at Christ Chiropractic Clinic to make that happen.
Christ Chiropractic, 821 Elm Street, Albany. ChristChiropracticClinic.com.
It hits the newsstands every month. It's colorful, glossy, and attractive. And it's filled with news and features for adults 50+. It's the Northwest 50+ magazine. All the articles and advertising are put together with you in mind. Content that makes a difference. Life-saving information. Upcoming events. Travel. Profiles of interesting people. It's all in one beautiful place. Every monthly issue of the Northwest 50+ magazine. Pick up your free copy or subscribe and have it delivered to you. Also online at northwest50plus.com.
It's a menu like you've never seen before. White Wind Superfoods in downtown Corvallis has a big menu above the counter with an array of the healthiest, tastiest smoothies and juices and other specialties. And you can see it all online at whitewindsuperfoods.com. Pick out what you like, call ahead, and your selections will be waiting for you. Organic, fresh, and delicious. Your new favorite spot, White Wind Superfoods on Madison between 2nd and 3rd in downtown Corvallis. On the web at whitewindsuperfoods.com.
Did you know your shopping decisions can make a difference in your community? It does with Points for Profit. When you shop locally with our businesses and save your receipts, you help 30 local charities who work to sustain our community. For a complete list, visit pointsforprofit.org. And remember, shop locally, serve locally, sustain locally with Points for Profit. This message is brought to you by the following Points for Profit sponsors. Please shop them and save your receipts.
Lynn Lane's Bowling is an 18-lane house with league and open bowling, a pro shop, restaurant, and lounge, all located on Main Road in Lebanon.
J&C Barbecue in Lebanon has become famous for their traditional wood-smoked meats. No pellets or gas, just good old-fashioned oak firewood. It's Southern barbecue without having to travel south. J&C Barbecue.
Premier Floor Covering has you covered for flooring, countertops, tile, and blinds on Main Street in downtown Lebanon.
Are you looking for a new apartment to call home? One closer to family and friends? If you're a senior or have a disability and need some assistance, then Willamette Manor has an apartment ready for you. Take a Monday through Friday midday tour, you'll see why. Willamette Manor provides utilities, cable TV, meals, and personal care of the highest quality. To learn more, see Willamette Manor at the corner of 2nd and C Streets in Lebanon or call 541-258-8178. 541-258-8178.
A health threat anywhere is a health threat everywhere. I'm Dr. Phil. A new coronavirus outbreak called COVID-19 started in China and is spreading to many countries, including the U.S. It's critical to get the facts about how to protect our friends and loved ones. While CDC is working with states and communities to stop the spread of the virus, health workers and emergency response efforts need our support. The CDC Foundation, a nonprofit organization, is focusing on immediate and critical needs that help protect our communities here at home and those around the world. We can all play a role in stopping this deadly virus. Get updates, learn how to protect your friends and family, and find out how to help. Go to cdcfoundation.org. That's cdcfoundation.org. Together, our impact is greater.
This has been a public service announcement brought to you by the CDC Foundation.
Only in the forest can you see this. And this. And this. But nothing beats the moment you see that.
Cool!
That's your child's eyes opening up to a world of possibilities.
I didn't know it could do that!
Because one trip to the forest can spark a world of difference.
There are some moments only the forest can inspire. Find yours at discovertheforest.org. Learn about forests near you and discover cool things to do when you go, like hiking, canoeing, fishing, or camping. Or create your own adventure with family and friends, and you might just see this. Your moment's out there. Find it at discovertheforest.org. That's discovertheforest.org.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
The Morning Update, weekday mornings on News Talk 1580, KGAL.
With me today on Valley Talk is Richard Little. We know Richard as any number of things, as he, a lot like Don Lyon, our previous guest, has his talents dipped into all sorts of different areas of life. One of the things that he's excited to be is an entomologist. He calls it a bugologist, and he is especially interested in bees in the state of Oregon. And so we're going to talk to Mr. Little here about a thing called the Oregon Bee Project. Welcome back to KGAL.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So this Oregon Bee Project, something that from the info I have here in front of me, started in 2017. Tell us why it's there. What are you guys doing and why?
Okay. In 2013, many of us probably remember that in Wilsonville, there was a very large die-off of bumblebees due to a misapplication of pesticide.
I remember reporting that on the news here on KGAL. It was is really disheartening.
Yes, it
to
was.
Hear about.
And we actually had several other die-offs due to pesticide misapplications that same year.
Wow.
And so our lawmakers in Salem decided we need to try to do something about this to prevent this from happening in the future.
Right.
So a task force was created at that time by the Senate and Assembly with eight appointees by the governor to come up with a report to them on what do we need to do. And one of the things that came out of this was that the Oregon State University expanded their bee program. They had more money for their honeybee lab, and they had money to create this project here.
The Oregon Bee Project.
Correct. And we had Andy Melathopoulos, who oversees this project, and he is a pollination expert.
Now, you said the word, people will think his name is Anthony. It's not. It's actually Andony with a D, A-N-D-O-N-Y.
I do that to him all the time. My apologies, Andony.
No, you said Andony. You said,
okay.
You said it
well,
right. Yeah, you did good.
I'm very good at mangling words.
Well, I think that goes with my profession. I do that all the time, so don't feel bad, my friend. Richard Little is our guest, entomologist, or bugologist, as he likes to say. We're talking about the Oregon Bee Project. So this is a cooperative effort, then, with a number of organizations, not just Oregon State University.
That's correct.
But who
else
is involved?
The Oregon Department of Agriculture and the Oregon Department of Forestry are the other two major ones. But we do have numerous other state agencies that are part of this. So we try to work very closely with all these agencies so that we can help them better understand how some of their actions may or may not be hindering or helping the bees.
Right. So when you first got together and started figuring out what you wanted to do, what were the goals that were set up for the Oregon Beat Project? What were the things that were laid out there as, this is our mission, let's do this?
I think education is probably the biggest one.
Hmm.
Because
educating the public, in other words.
Educating the public as well as everyone else. The growers, the nurseries, golf course people, you name it. And in the process of going out and meeting with these people, we found a number of them were already very proactive in helping to protect the bee population on their property.
Hmm.
Some growers were very innovative. So we wanted to come up with ways to recognize them and to tell the rest of the people in Oregon who these people are and the good work that they're doing. And the other one, of course, was the big fundamental one, was people come up to us all the time and say, so how are the bees doing?
Yeah.
And the
and
sad
how do you answer that?
Do you have 2 hours?
Well, no, we got about 18 more minutes. That's
okay.
All.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what we do is we say we do know some bees are doing well, and we do know some are not doing well at all. Most of the others, we don't really know.
How can you find out?
Well, that is, we're one part of the Oregon Bee Project. We created the Oregon Bee Atlas. That is, we have people that we've trained as citizen science, where we train these people to go out and survey different parts of the state, collect the bee samples, pin them up, and do some basic identification. So from these collections that we're getting from around the state, we're beginning to fill in a lot of gaps in our knowledge about where are the bees and how are they doing.
As far as you know, how many types of bees are there in Oregon? You may not be able to give
we
the perfect...
We have a lot of discussions
correct.
About that.
Yeah.
I would say, just to cover all my bases with all my other fellow entomologists,
yeah.
somewhere between 500 and 900 species of bees in the state.
Hokey smokes. I've got a Bees of Oregon photograph here on a card that Richard gave me when he came in, and there are, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times 3 is 18. 18 types of bees.
The more common ones.
Yeah, the more common ones. And I couldn't have named, oh, goodness, probably 15 of these, maybe 14 of them I would never have come up with. Maybe only 2 or 3. And that, I might be pushing it there. I had no idea. So it's very possible when we're out on a picnic or up in the woods, you know, going swimming somewhere or camping, that when we see a bee, we may just assume it's a certain type of bee we're familiar with, but probably it's something else, or a good chance that it is.
There's a very real good possibility of that, yes.
And when you look at these up close, these photographs are a little larger than life size.
They're actually quite a bit larger than life size.
You can really see the differences in these bees. It's incredible. They look like completely different creatures from each other. Similarities in certain aspects, but very, very different.
Well, we have some bees that are very, very small. As a matter of fact, the smallest bee that we know of in the state so far is only about 2 millimeters long.
You can't even see that one then.
Most people have no idea it's a bee when they see it.
Yeah, if you're 10 feet away, you probably would not even notice it, right?
No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't. And then our larger ones would be some of the queen bumblebees. And occasionally in the southern part of Oregon, we see some of the larger carpenter bees. And they can approach an inch and a quarter. Or, somewhere around 35, 40 millimeters.
Now,
quite a bit difference in size.
I've talked to you just briefly about bees before. And if I am remembering correctly, and please correct me if I'm not remembering correctly, but not every kind of bee that you might see is likely to sting you.
Actually, very, very few bees will. And the only bees I've ever been stung by are honeybees and a few bumblebees, which is my own fault. I have never been stung by any of these other bees.
Huh.
Most of them are incapable of stinging to begin with simply because they're so small. Even if they tried to, their stingers could not penetrate our skin.
Because they're just so tiny.
Right. So stinging is not an issue. If you talk about wasps and hornets, that's a totally different thing.
Right. Yeah, you don't want to monkey with those. My wife was stung by a wasp. We were painting our house here in the last few weeks, and the outside of our house, and we had a wasp nest, and I had to take care of it, and but there were still some wasps hanging around that wanted to create a new nest in that same general area. And
that's quite common.
Yeah, we were painting, and we thought we were clear of them, but one of them, Becky, was in its way or something, somehow angered it, and it stung her, and I felt bad for her. That really hurt.
One of the things I like to tell people, because you made me think of this when you brought up the wasp thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Is most people tend to interchange the two. Think of them as one and the same. Where wasps and bees are very, very different. And a good way to remember it would be wasps are carnivores and bees are herbivores.
Right. So it would be wasps that would hang around your chicken at a barbecue or whatever.
Exactly.
Those aren't bees.
They want the protein, the meat.
Right.
Where bees have no idea what meat is. They're only interested in pollen and nectar. So when you're blaming that buzzing thing around your face during your picnic on a bee, it's not.
That's right.
So don't slander my friends, please.
Okay. I'll try to remember that. When I was a kid, we all thought they were bees.
Yeah.
Said, oh, get
That's
that
very typical.
Stupid bee. It won't leave me alone. Let me eat my hamburger, you know.
Right.
Yeah, so that, wow, that's good to know. So wasps are carnivores. And there's another thing besides a wasp that's like a wasp, right? Or is it like a couple different types of wasps?
Oh, yes, we do have many different kinds of wasps.
They all kind of behave similarly, or are they?
Oh, no, the ranges are just absolutely incredible.
Well, I opened up another can of insects there, didn't I?
That's about another 20 hours there.
There you go. Man. So... Was it when you were a kid that you got interested in bugs and such, or did that come later in life for you?
No, it actually started when I was a child. I was fascinated by spiders.
Mm.
And I used to collect flies and other things and toss them in the web to see how they would work. And so I became
I'm sure the flies didn't appreciate that very much.
No, but it's the nature of things. If I didn't throw it in, something else would, so to speak.
Right, yeah, it would eventually would have been.
But... You know, there's not too many jobs in the country that pertain to spiders.
Right. Yeah, how are you going to make a living?
No, it's very difficult, very challenging. Anyway, through the insects, or the spiders, I should say, I became involved with insects. And when I got into bees, I became very fascinated by bees, and I tried to specialize in them. So you'll see many entomologists have a tendency to specialize in certain types of insects that they prefer.
And why did bees capture your attention? Or can you even express it?
I wished I could tell you why, but I can't. They just captured my passion.
Hmm.
You know, and I'm sure people who are passionate about things have a very hard time explaining why am I passionate about this other than the fact that I am.
Yes. Yeah, it's something very real. You sense it, but you may not be able to describe why. Well, the Oregon Bee Project is our topic today, as well as insects and other things, is whatever happens to come into our mind here. We're talking with Richard Little. He's an entomologist, likes to call himself a bugologist, which I like words like that, bugologist. And Richard, you have some ideas for how people like myself that have a yard at home can actually help bees out. How can we give bees a hand?
Oh, yes, there's many things one can do in your yard. Probably the most important thing is to create a diversity of flowers because that's their food source. So we try to tell people, think of having flowers in your garden from frost to frost, from early in the spring to late in the fall.
So various types of flowers that will bloom at different times.
Correct.
Covering that whole season other than the dead of winter when really
right.
nothing
so
blooms.
So in other words, if you have flowers blooming all the time, you're more likely to be providing food for the bees.
There you go.
Now,
and for
you want a
hummingbirds
diversity of
and
flowers.
Things like that, for that matter.
Yes.
As well. They love that stuff. So.
Yes.
Yep. They're fun to see.
And the other critical one is habitat for nesting. That is, the bees need a place to rear their young. And a proper nesting place is probably one of the most limiting factors to bees' reproduction success. Now,
what is a proper place?
Okay, we generally have two groups. We have, all of them are solitary nesters, but those, the majority of them, about 70% of them, nest in the ground. They actually dig their way into the ground, and in the tunnels that they dig, they lay their eggs.
Hmm.
The other 25-30% of the bees are cavity nesters. They need a pre-existing hole. That would be like a hole that's in an old tree trunk that a beetle made or something along that line. So most people, when they want a garden, they tend to put mulch everywhere. And that covers up all the bare dirt.
Oh, yeah.
And that means the bees don't have a place to nest. So it's good to leave some bare places in your garden. And if you don't want them out front where people can see it, by all means, put it in the back somewhere, but do leave bare dirt.
The bees will find it if it's there.
The bees will find it.
Right. It doesn't have to be on display.
And for cavity nesting, there's a lot of things you can use there. I mean, you can go all the way to buying commercially produced mason bee houses to making them yourself.
And those will work? Will the bees inhabit them somehow?
Well,
or you have to put them in there? I mean, how does that work?
Well, you create little tubes about maybe the size of a pencil.
Right.
And it could be anywhere from 4 to 6 inches long, depending on the bee you're trying to help.
Mm-hmm.
And these tubes are what bees will use for nesting. A mason bee, for example, when she finds a tube, whether it's one we've provided artificially or one that's naturally occurring, she scouts it out and says, oh, yeah, this is a good place. She goes in, makes a mud wall. Then she goes around and collects a lot of pollen and nectar over many, many trips to create a ball of pollen and nectar about the size of a pea. And she lays one egg on it. Then she partitions that cell off and starts another one. So the series of cells are in that hole. And in the following year, they will emerge.
About that, and they will emerge having grown from that food, that fuel, that pollen that the bee has put in there.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So
wow.
All their food they're going to get until they come out the next year is in that little ball of pollen and nectar. That's it. That's all they get.
What a brilliant plan. That is. I didn't know how that worked. It's neat. So, to go back over, in case people just tuned in, if you'd like to help bees out, we're talking about the Oregon Bee Project, which is a collection of various agencies, including Oregon State University, the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and the Department of Forestry, working together to determine not only how bees are doing in the state of Oregon, but also to try to educate people on how to help bees out, and so that we don't lose species of bees, and so we can have a healthy, and to sort of in that education effort to try to demythify bees. For people, like we just heard just a moment ago from Richard, that very few bees would ever sting you. A honeybee would be one of the very few that might, and only if you get in its way or bother it. Most of them don't or won't. Even if they tried, they couldn't because they're too small or frail for their stinger to penetrate your skin. I didn't know that. And that wasps are a completely separate thing from bees. They're carnivores. Bees are not. So they're the ones, those dumb wasps are the ones bugging you at your picnic, not the bees.
Right. 95% of my stings are wasps.
And these are just a few of the things we've learned already as we have Richard Little here, entomologist, here on Valley Talk. So this bee atlas that you guys are creating, this is an effort to try to find out in as full and complete a way as you can what species of bees are living where and maybe about how many or how they're doing and where they're living, right?
Well, right now we're trying to find out who's out there.
Yeah.
And so we have these teams, like last year we had these teams with the Oregon Bee Atlas, and we collected over that period of last year approximately 20,000 plus species.
Oh, man.
Excuse me, 20,000 plus specimens.
Specimens.
Of bees.
Of bees. And of that, so, they were all among the 500 plus known species in the state.
Well, actually we found one new one.
You did?
And we have reasons to believe, and we also know that we found some of the bees in areas we've never seen before. We had no records of them occurring there. So we are definitely finding out some very important information. And we're hoping that over the next couple of years, when we keep going out and continuing these surveys, we will be able to fill even more of the holes in our gaps of knowledge.
Sure. Well, this one new species of bee that you found, is it new completely like to the world of bees, or is it new to Oregon?
It has not been described.
So, really? Ever.
And as That's correct.
Wow.
But, you know, we have a bee taxonomist who works in this program. And I don't want to jump ahead on his work.
Right.
But it's a very difficult thing to look at a bee and say, oh, this is not, you know, this is something brand new. He can do that. I cannot.
Right.
You know, because some of these bees, we don't even have good keys to tell them apart. So it's very hard sometimes when you say, oh, this looks like that bee, but, you know, there's a lot of knowledge we just don't have. So give us a couple more years and I'll be able to answer that.
All right, good. We'll try to remember to have you back in a couple of years. Well, as we wrap up here, let's tell people how they can find out more.
Please do.
And go beyond our conversation we've had today. The best place you can go for information on the web would be the Oregon Beekeeping website. It's OregonBeeProject.org, OregonBeeProject.org. And then if you want to go on Facebook, just look for Oregon Bee Project. And apparently there's a Twitter handle here, too, @OregonBeePro, @OregonBeePro would be for Twitter. And we've got about 30 seconds for you just to encourage folks to jump on one of those places, find out more, and be a part of the effort.
We will be delighted to hear from you. So thank you, and thank you, bees, for a lot of what you eat.
There you go. And bees sometime come back, and we should talk about what bees actually do.
It, I would be delighted.
This was so general of a discussion. Maybe we'd come back and do one where we talk about really what bees are doing all the time and how it benefits us, because they're doing this in the background, living their lives, and benefiting us in ways that we probably don't even realize. I'm certain of that, and I know you can tell us how that's working. So let's make sure we do that. Let's set up a time and have you
back. I'd be delighted.
All right.
Thank you very much, Richard Little.
Thank you, Richard, very much.
Your RV may feel like home, but when it comes to supplies and maintenance, it's really quite different. At Lassen RV, we carry everything you need to keep your RV in tip-top condition. And because we buy in volume, we pass our savings on to you, from caulking to sewer hoses to toilet paper, all specially made for RV living. Lassen RV Parts and Service, where friends send their friends. Just east of I-5 on Highway 20 in Albany and at LassenRV.com.
Looking to save money on lighting fixtures, lamps, shades, special gifts, home and garden decor? Larry and Marge Tomlin, owners of J&J Electric, invite you to see the high quality and low prices at J&J Electric. J&J has been in the electrical business for over 50 years, so you know their products and knowledge are the best. Visit J&J's spectacular showroom. The hometown folks at J&J Electric appreciate your business. At your service for over 50 years. J&J Electric, South Pacific and 22nd in Albany.
New Horizons In-Home Care now hiring caregivers in Corvallis, Eugene, Salem, and Florence. With lots of hours available, multiple shifts, and competitive wage scale, apply at any one of their locations in Corvallis, Eugene, Salem, or Florence, Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 4, to complete an application and have an on-the-spot interview. For more information, please call 541-752-9059. That's 752-9059. Or visit newhorizonsinhomecare.com.
Natural remedies to help whiten your teeth. I'm Dr. Travis Stork, host of The Doctors, and these are The Doctor's Orders. Having yellow teeth can certainly be embarrassing. To help whiten them, try eating mashed up strawberries. This is a great natural treatment that contains malic acid, which can help prevent yellow teeth. Another great natural remedy for brightening up your smile, oranges. Rubbing the inside of an orange peel on your teeth can actually lift tartar and plaque off your teeth and helps remove stains. Of course, always remember to brush and floss often. And for more drastic whitening results, consult your dentist. For more information, log on to thedoctorstv.com. I'm Dr. Travis Stork, and those are The Doctor's Orders.
Presented by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, who understands that it's not just a mortgage, it's your mortgage. That's the difference. Rocket Mortgage. Push button, get mortgage.
I'm breaking the cycle.
Hi, I'm Troy with the Better Kids Club. We're a local nonprofit organization in Albany that works with children whose lives have been affected by parents with addiction. We provide a safe, positive environment, with or without their parent, where kids can interact, participate in fun and educational activities. Parents and children working together with the community. breaking the cycle of addiction, creating positive change.
I, Kendra Whisper, pledge allegiance to the Better Kids Club to make choices that are good for my future, as well as encourage other kids to also make good choices.
If you know a child, want to volunteer, or to help our program with funding, check us out on Facebook. Or for more information, email us at betterkidsclub@gmail.com or call 541-936-5980. That's 936-5980. The Better Kids Club is making life fun and positive for our local youth.
I'm breaking the cycle.
Southpaw's Perfect Pizza and Sports Pub and Major League Burger Shakes and Fries is only doing takeout and delivery till further notice. Order now by calling 541-791-7663 or online at southpawspizzaandsportsbar.com. You can also order on doordash.com or smartonlineorder.com. Southpaw's Perfect Pizza and Major League Burgers is only doing takeout and delivery till further notice. 560 Northwest Hickory Street in North Albany.
You won't find many buildings in Langtree, Texas, so perhaps it shouldn't be a surprise that two establishments needed to share a location due to the small size of the town. But putting a courthouse inside a saloon was bound to produce unique results. The story is this edition on the American Countryside. A Farm in the Countryside podcast, we're talking about the stories, tips, and trends affecting agricultural and rural America. What can you expect in the markets? How do you evaluate new technology? What are the latest trends when it comes to successful crop and livestock operations? Those topics and many more are our weekly focus with guests from across the nation. Farming the Countryside is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Find the Farming the Countryside podcast on the AgriTalk app or just use your favorite podcast platform. And you can follow our show on Facebook. Catch Farming the Countryside for a weekly look at the stories affecting rural and agricultural America.
Picture yourself driving the tractor of your dreams, creeping up and down the rolling hills, enjoying an incredible sunset, and feeling satisfied that you are able to finally find your dream tractor at a reasonable price. Visit MachineryPete.com for the best selection of used tractors, skid steers, mowers, and more. We've revolutionized searching for equipment online. Find exactly what you're looking for quickly and easily. Your next piece of equipment is only a click away on MachineryPete.com. Visit MachineryPete.com now.
In 1882, Roy Bean became Justice of the Peace, administering law from Langtree, Texas, despite the fact he had no formal training for such work. From the beginning, he mixed the work of saloonkeeper with his new role of dispensing justice in an area along the Rio Grande River.
From day one, this was the saloon and courthouse. If there needed to be someone tried, he would close down the saloon, he would open up the court and hold court, and then say, okay, court is dismissed, and open the saloon back up again.
Becky Foster shares the story from the Judge Roy Bean Visitor Center in Langtree, Texas. Fines and Bean's saloon turned courthouse could be far different than you'd find in other places.
He is somewhat known for fining people maybe a round of drinks for the house, so he profited a little bit on the side from it too.
And it was those unusual judgments and fines that perhaps made Bean a character still known today.
There's a story about there was a man found dead in the street, and he was fined $35, which happened to be how much was in his pockets at the time, for trespassing.
The money he fined the dead man was used to pay for funeral expenses. Despite the unusual fines, Bean did seem to keep the peace in a place that could be plenty rowdy.
He was a successful lawman, and he was a successful business owner out here. And he's far enough away that he can kind of do what he wants. All those things put together kept him here for over 20 years.
Bean made a proclamation that could still be found hanging above his saloon in Langtree.
Part of his character and reputation that he started calling himself the law west of the Pecos, and that would be west of the Pecos River, that's just 18 miles east of here.
But it was Bean's love for a star of the day that made him well known as well. And that story is next time as we travel the countryside in Langtree, Texas. I'm Andrew McCray.
Your first choice in local news, sports, and smart talk. This is News Talk 1580 KGA.